Welcome to the Davis Arts Center. Glad to have you here. I'm James Lee Job. I'll be your host. I want to send out special thanks to the Arts Center for letting us have this space every month. Thank you. We appreciate it very much. There are catalogs around on the table back there, I believe, or brochures, but also you can find out information on all the wonderful classes here online at Davis Arts, with an S at the end, artscenter.org. And let's see, we've got dance, we've got ceramics, we've got drawing, we've got one of the featured writers' poetry classes here, and it's just all kinds of stuff. So please, please, please use some of it. We have two wonderful writers today, Amanda Hawkins and Naomi J. Williams. Amanda Hawkins was the winner. Everybody has won awards, you know, like there's like a lot of awards here. Amanda Hawkins was winner of the 2018 Editor's Prize for Poetry at the Florida Review and the recipient of scholarships from the Breadloaf Environmental Writers Conference, Napa Valley Writers Conference, Key West Limit Literary Seminar, and about eight other places. Her work has appeared in the Boston Review, the Crab Orchard Review, the Cincinnati Review, Orion, Terrain, and Tin House. She teaches here and at William Jessup University and lives in the land of wood just to the north of us. Please welcome Amanda Hawkins. I see you've got some water, but I left some water for you both up here if you need
just
it.
Just in case.
Yeah.
Just in case. Thank you. Thank you, James, for having me back. Can you hear me? We're a small space. I did a reading very recently, and the person putting it on heard a poem that I read online, and he was like, I think you're going to need a microphone. We have, you know, hard of hearing people here, and you just sound really quiet. I was just like, I really don't think I'm that quiet, but okay, whatever. So James had me here last year on Father's Day, which I expected no one to come, quite honestly, because it's like, I don't know. You want to be with family. But people came and it was wonderful. And so thank you for having me back again so soon. I'm going to totally cheat in a glorious way and live off of the prose experience here. I will end with prose, I think. I will begin with poetry just to get us started. I'm working on a manuscript called Whale Fall, so that's like a warning for you. There are whales, lots of whales in a lot of these poems, and there's a lot of death. A whale fall is a dead whale. So be forewarned. There's lots of death here. But the first poem that I want to read for you is called After the Election. So, after the election, of course darkness. Of course a milky white shroud. Of course no high and beautiful breach. Instead, a curved black. A body's foul breath on the wind. Our sense of direction, obviously off. The only sound, the slosh of waves, the burst of air from the spout, the muffled fog, and the periodic pound of fists against the kayak's hard plastic. Because our guide had made it clear, his job was not to keep us, his job was not to help us get close to the whales. His job was to keep the whales a safe distance. Yeah, so that was after the election. This is called In the Year of Salt and Death, or Death. This is after Aracelis Germain. I might be butchering that name. I'm not great with that. But In the Year of Salt and Death. I expected the darkness in that desert to be complete. No cities for miles. No moisture collecting into clouds to cloud the view and pollute the night. That year, two of my beloveds died. But it did not stop. There were so many, bodies also sick or old or blasted through with shrapnel or slipped into the sea and drowned and sunk to the bottom of oceans. That could be a metaphor. I could mean the 52 million that year addicted and or overdosed, sunk to their own silt end, the 65,000 the year after, the 1.2 billion on dry land in XYZ war zone or not, threatened by violence, crushed, sick or starved, the 1 million others climbed to shore, lived, thank God, but they keep, dying or wanting to be dead. Is there an end? It is possible. That was the year. I visited the ocean and the desert both after a long absence. I noticed how strong the salt, stung chapped lips, the rock around where I stood, the ocean, the desert, the rocks, volcanic, tortured, and so different from all I touched before. The bodies sunk somewhere particular, but I imagined them in the same salted water I touched. In light of current events, I watched YouTube videos and news broadcasts, read articles for free, and even paid for subscriptions to be sure my students knew what was happening. I didn't say much in conversations, but in class I asked a lot of questions, stated the facts that year gun death and vehicle death statistics converged. I received boxes of shells as inheritance, the numbers of American right-wing attack deaths and jihadist attack deaths also converged, and the shells, so varied and fragile and so not from guns, she had cataloged each collection by type, the smallest, snail shells and starfish, the dull fingered limpet and the white Pacific little neck clam, the clam shells with the striations, the ones with the swirls. Small, medium, and large sand dollars, I kept all of them in a box in the garage next to her collection of rocks and fossils. I don't know all the names. I have spent so much time researching that year. Does the year ever end? The other day, I walked into a museum and had an anxiety attack. I saw a man standing behind a meteorite on display. I believed he fit the profile of a mass shooter, all sunburn and white rage. What is the official profile of a mass shooter? What is the slope of his nose, and does his chin recede? After my first fight or flight response, I thought he must be some kind of museum joke. Here stands a sample, a source of mass destruction from the Anthropocene. What does a shooter look like when he isn't killing people? And by people, I mean the tender, children like my own, old ladies who don't know any better but to enjoy the view. I mean the devoted, people of churches, mosques, temples, schools, people of the wrong, churches, mosques, temples, schools, I mean. What are we going to tell our grandchildren if we live long enough to respond when they ask, what did you do in the year of salt and death that didn't stop for decades? I say, I expected the darkness to be complete, but perhaps I didn't fathom the connection of one body and another body, one death and another death, the warmth of the open chasm of the mouth, the light on some nights, so intensely bright and almost too much, even if only the salt of stars. That's a mouthful. This is called Bears Ears National Monument and Other Diminishing Lands. What gods do we grope in common? What land sprawls to the west? What oceans will swallow our solid continents? I wanted the remnants, the salvageable, bones kept clean and away from light. The paintings One might stand too close. The breath to carry the unseen, water droplets decay, what would be preserved. Kept, I thought, was the operative word suspended, the holy, space set aside. Who says such preservation is in contention with logic? Land means to lie bare, flat, folded, stacked or ripped along a seam. The bones of the dead are everywhere, believed to be sacred, the land exposed but most hidden by oceans rising, but the land being by nature a surface. When I say land, sometimes I mean belief, desire, longing. When I say ocean, I mean all the rest, articulated with the mouth's profane shape. I mean to say how the body moves is praxis. The paintings on the stone were roped off to keep pilgrims from touching, to preserve what could be lost. But when I say the bones, I mean the bones. So this all started, this particular manuscript started on the coast. Surprise. And this was the first poem I remember writing in it. And I don't know if that is just me looking back in understanding or an actual memory. So I like that slippage, but this is called Whale Fall. It's a title poem. I imagined a place, the great whales congregate, a death trench, blue body after blue body, carried down some current to the ocean floor. I can't imagine anything more beautiful than the cold depths, whales settled into darkness, huge muscled questions stacked on sand, a kind of preservation. For weeks, I kept the words written on the back of my hand, kept bringing it up. How these communities for the dead must mean something. Imagine this. A whale fall is both a body and a place. I thought you turned it off. This is my phone. Donna Hawkins, sorry. Mother-in-law. That was classic. Okay. I don't even know where it was. What?
Are you sure you don't want to take it?
She's probably listening right now. I don't even know where it was. So what's the point here? Yeah, we might just leave it at that. Imagine this. A whale fall is both a body and a place. The body makes the place. Okay. Wow, that was fun. More serious. I also spent a lot of time in the desert, so there happens to be a lot of desert in these poems as well. This one is called Plain Speak. It's after Camille Dungy, but talked to her and she saw that it was, and she was like, you don't have to say that, but I'm saying it anyway, because she's awesome. I wanted to be there when she died. There is no sheltered way to say this. Today, I watched a storm cloud hulk its way across the valley. It took all day. A week ago, the weather forecast said rain, so I watched and waited. The sky was the deep color of distant waves. The air was a net with holes. The ravens rolled off updrafts from the hills, as if swimming and flight were, after all this millennia, the same. I watched and I listened. All day, the bees found the rosemary. The dark-eyed juncos pitched their shrills under the eaves. the tabaquillo that creeps under the side of the cement slab porch probably grew new cells. All day long, the storm came near, and the miraculous, sparse tufts of grass whipped about in the wind. The legs of the kit fox twitched. I asked the man at the ranger station, "What is this soil's name?" And he spoke like an old world prophet. "Call it sandy loam. Call it fine sandy loam. Call it unweathered bedrock." The name, he said, and the earth's composition depends on the area. When finally the rains came, it was late. I heard a splash on the window pane. The wind was tossing water at the side of the house. The bees were gone. The juncos gone. The raven was not in my line of sight. The cloud, once at such a distance, hung so close it looked like fog. I tell you this so that you will know how much I wanted to be there when she died. How long a body can wait. There was a phone call the night before, a mention of a rattle at the windows of her lungs, but I had not the least perceptions of the code you spoke. "The time is close," you could have said, "come soon." The time is close, meaning it could take all day. Come anyway. So two people died in this one proximity of a year, and that was a while ago, so I'm okay, just so you know. This is desertification. Something about a boy who dies just after his fourth birthday, his brain ravaged, like land cleared of itself, like trees broken off and pulled like teeth, like land left bare after such intensive agriculture, nothing of what once lived could live there again. Of course, the difference is the sweet boy died and we could hold his lifeless body in our arms and he could cry from confusion and fear when the doctors strapped him down that last time to begin the tests. Of course, the real difference is he was a body, not a place. Though if you ask his mother, she would say he was his own landscape. I'll read a couple more poems. I think I have time, yes? Fractaline. The mountains keep repeating themselves, far and away, ridge over ridge, swell over swell. I might as well be drowned and sunk to the ocean floor. It does not matter that this is land. There is little water, and the water here on the surface evaporates at such a rate, even the lakes are salt. I keep expecting to see a whale fall outside my window. What is land anyway? Under the ocean, at the bottom of the deep, the same valleys, the same mountains, rising to a ridge, same canyons. The difference between canyon and trench, one is the carve of erosion, think rivers and streams. A trench is a rend, the tear of tectonic plates, also often slow, but these are the deepest places of our world. The mountains keep repeating themselves. Why does it seem we also rise and fall in cycles? I mean, why do we grieve without grief over and over again? The mountains roll blue at the distance. The same mountains, nose close, break beige. God, I would tear at that surface, a trench like a bottomless grave. What would I find at its lowest most fathoms? Does it have a name? There is too much in this world to grieve. The boy was too young to gain anything from dying. The woman old enough, but still the generations see the sweet beasts fall, headless and stinking. Loss of topsoil, ozone, ice, dry land, Homo sapiens, sapiens, wars and unwars, and fighting to the teeth, our teeth clenched and crushed, our gums bleed and recede. I like to read that one close to the whale's name, this next poem. Its proximity matters. Perhaps the whale's name. All it is skeleton, hanging from the ceiling of a church. Or something like a church. Windows, height, and depth suggest something, like sacredness. The museum designed to highlight and hold the magnificent. Draw the body in, coax the visitor's eyes first wide to take the emptiness in, then up to all that hollowness. Call it suspended. Set in live motion, the body curves as if swimming. The great mouth opens as if to feed. There used to be a Diplodocus called Dippy opposite the whale's place. A tribute to the last great mass extinction. They replaced it with these bones of blue whale as if to say, look here. We almost killed off the ocean's greatest with our own hands. Extinction, not from cataclysmic event, but from greed. The Earth, says one scientist, is teetering on the edge. Widespread death. Initiated again from humans. Hope is we have learned our lesson and have not yet tipped into the sixth. But how easy it is to lose information, knowledge, belief. For a while, we almost even lost the art of articulation of animals large as this. The size and oil content in the bones makes the process challenging. But not just the whale. The very building where it hangs means to convert the visitor, their perspective, how they can see the whale, but also beyond the ceiling and its 162 illustrated panels of plants from around the world. They tell a story of emerging and fallen empires, prosperity and slavery, explorers pushing the boundaries of the known world. Their known world, forgive for a moment the colonial perspective and see what could be called the natural history version of a cathedral dome. Each detail meant to be read, a focus, not just for meditation or reflection of what once or now exists, but like an icon, like a narthex, this hall and this hope is entrance.
Let's hear it for the poems.
So this is just one essay. It's called Catalog of Light. It's actually a lyric essay. It's in Cincinnati Review, and it's just nice and heavy. The book is, so I wrote this instead. It's the nice thing about having a book to read out of, which I see you don't actually have to read of, but whatever. I like the heft. So lyric essay, so it's kind of like straddles the worlds of poetry and prose. Lots of pause in there. When my father was 22 years old, one of his closest friends died suddenly. After the first few moments of shock wore off, my father remembered the night before. In his room, as he lay down to sleep, a ball of light appeared near the ceiling. Just like that. A ball of light. hovered above the bed. Later, my father asked the officers what time his friend had passed. St. Elmo's fire is a flicker of light at the tip of a mast in a storm at sea, a weather phenomenon akin to lightning. Only, lightning is the movement of electricity from charged thing to charged thing, and St. Elmo's fire is just sparking, a burst of electrons into air. There's an electrical imbalance, and the molecules tear. A will-o'-the-wisp is a flickering orb of ghost light, an atmospheric condition common in humidity. People wandering about in the darkness have found them hovering over swamps, bogs, marshes, but I don't know a soul who's seen one. Will-o'-the-wisp may be spotted less often now because most marshlands have been drained for practical ventures like agriculture or housing. It doesn't perhaps matter. Will-o'-the-wisps are often believed to be connected to the souls of the dead, or fairies, or other supernatural spirits that mean to drown those looking on. The lights flicker away from the path and attract the lonely traveler. As one approaches the light, so the light recedes, and the seeker never quite finds. Moses came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush, and Moses saw that the bush was on fire. And though it was on fire, it did not burn up. The source of the name St. Elmo might be a mispronunciation of St. Elmo or St. Erasmus, the patron saint of sailors. Perhaps because at sea the sight was so common. But the blue flame isn't seen only on the ocean, and it doesn't actually burn. It can happen anywhere, in a thunderstorm, from the sharp tip of a pole, or on land, at the eruption of a volcano. St. Elmo's flames have been sighted up on a church's spire, or on the high ridge of a tomb. And one man made it happen himself, Nikola Tesla, conducting electricity from a Tesla coil, reported seeing St. Elmo's fire over it. Also reported, a butterfly, wingtips lit with blue halos, flying around the room. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses, do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." In the Eastern Orthodox tradition, the burning bush is called the unburnt bush. The flame Moses saw was a light, not fire, from the glory of God. And the vision itself is directly linked to the Theotokos, to Mary, Mother of God, who carried divinity in her womb and yet was unconsumed. Etiology, the study of origination, of causation, the study of why. An etiological myth is a story to explain a name or create a history for a family, people, or place. It comes from the Greek etiologia, to give reason for. The term is also used for the study of the origins of disease. In naming, etiology participates in stories that make sense of this life. My father does not often tell the story. At the time, he thought the spirit of his friend was visiting him. But then he read, "To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord," and God was not one for confusion. So he used to say, it must have been some demon posing as an angel of light. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people. I have heard them crying out. I am concerned about their suffering." Many places and many times it has been said, God came down. Legends like this, of burning bushes and a voice like thunder, compel their tellers' descendants to make a claim on place. We want to locate where exactly the bush burned, where the voice of God rang out, on which mountain, which swath of sky spread over the happenings, which valley lay below, on which corner of the earth did God appear, and can we go there again? It isn't only about revelation. The Lord came down to see something, talk to someone, warn, hold accountable, destroy the usual divine tendencies. Let's assume all this is true. Theophany is the appearance of divine. Epiphany is likewise a showing forth of deity. Both share a common source in Greek, phainein, to show, and are related to the modern use of phantasm. In Old French, phantasma has the nuance of dream, illusion, or fantasy. In Greek, phantasma can mean image, apparition, or unreality. In most claims of theophany, there is a recurring theme of light, fire, emanation. For much of history, light was too intricate to parse out completely. Light seems somehow akin to dream, belonging to the unreal as much as the real, to the super as much as natural. We cannot understand, and therefore phantasm. The trouble remains, how on earth could we possibly know our origins? The earth moves ever, it plays in shifts, our memories are muddled. Our histories consist of fact and fiction in the first place. They begin in one space, one dry patch of grass, burst into flame, and travel to quite another. In the end, any rise in land becomes something more akin to mountains, and there wasn't a spark, only there was God, consuming all and yet not consuming anything. Someone got creative. Someone needed to tell the etiology of bitterness, the source of suffering, the beginning of pain. It is not my intent to break it all down. I am not presenting a story as fact and then yanking the carpet out from under our feet. A story is not a joke. Don't lead someone down a path and then whap them upside the head. Don't lead someone to think some real thing and then in the end, poof, it was all a bad dream. This is not a dream. This is not a straw man I'm pulling apart at the seams. Sometime, somewhere, there was a God. Sometime, somewhere, the God came down. Don't we all have these stories we tell ourselves to live, to believe, keep believing? My father's friend died at the exact time the ball of light appeared. These days, he tells us, he's not quite sure what to make of it. Neither am I. I believe enough now about the body and the mind, how they intertwine, that I realize such experiences seem to come only to those who need them, or those who need the stories hold on. At the time of the death and the light, my father was dabbling, as he'd say. He and his friend would predict on cue certain silly things, a phone call, a knock at the door, other menial happenings that didn't make much difference in their day-to-day lives. It didn't make much difference, and yet that psychic dabbling seemed to mean that something in this world was transpiring, just beyond their understanding and control. They had seen a glimmer, and they were both beginning to turn. And then he died, and then the light and the history blurs. Mostly, I don't believe in God. Sometimes I believe so hard my head hurts. I'm not being clever. What seems true? At one time, in one place, a ball of light appeared near a ceiling and hovered above a bed. Its experience, its appearance, coincided with death. Its appearance was the beginning of another deepening of a long history of awareness. How he tells the story has changed, like any unexplainable encounter, to fit with his shifting perspectives of beliefs. Sometime, somewhere, someone believed in God. Sometime, somewhere, the ball of light came down. Someone believed light could be more than atmospheric trick. It hurts no one to believe this. Thank you.
That was pitiful. Come on, one more time. Come on. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. All these Moses things kept coming to me, you know. And doesn't it say somewhere in Exodus that Moses had a stammer and that Aaron would speak for him? Isn't that in there somewhere? It's been a long time for me. But it gives me this image of Moses coming down with the tablets and going, "You sin in sunset. And Aaron saying, "I got this." Clearly mistakes have been made. But the thing with Moses that really, because he does some great feats to convince the Pharaoh to let his people go. Not just the splitting of the Red Sea, that's the big finale, but he makes it rain blood. Yeah, and the Pharaoh says, "No, I'm not. You make it rain blood, anything you want. I am not messing with you." You know, that's tough. I'm never sure how much of these things you guys really want me to read. You know,
just, I don't care.
Oh, okay. Because yours is like a big one. It's like a book, you know. No, I'm just kidding. Come on. Naomi Williams was born in Japan and spoke no English until she was 6 years old. My wife's from Chicago, so pretty much the same thing for her. She's the author of Landfall's... don't tell her that. Some of you know her. She's the author of Landfall's long-listed for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize and the National Book Critics Circle's Critics Circle John Leonard Award. A five-time Pushcart Prize nominee and one-time winner, Naomi's published short fiction in numerous journals, including American Short Fiction, Ninth Letter, A Public Space. There's a long list here. She co-directs the long-running series Stories on Stage Davis and teaches with the low residency MFA program at Ashland University. After living in Davis for many years, she has escaped and lives now on the other side of that causeway. Please welcome Naomi Williams. Yeah. It's getting dark. I'm going to go turn on lights. You go ahead and start.
The reason I don't read from a book is because I can't really see the print anymore, you know? I also can't open this water. Here. Is there a trick?
I don't know.
You just need more strength, I think.
Thumbs up.
Let's just ignore the little flip cap.
Okay, there we go. All right. Let there be light.
Let there be light, yeah. Yes. Keep me to it.
Okay. Thank you all so much for coming today. Thanks to James Lee Jobe for inviting me to crash a poetry party. I mostly write prose. And I'm also really delighted to be back at the Davis Arts Center. It's been a while since I've been here. I have a long association with this place. I started as a student here when I first moved to Davis. This was where I came and met my first writer friends. And I've also been a teacher here, so I'm really glad you're here, Stacy, and it's really, really nice to be in this beautiful spot again. I did bring a few paperback copies of my book, Landfalls. I'm selling them for $10 a piece if you want one. I'm not reading from it today. I've sort of moved on to other projects. So, Yeah, when you were reading all about whales and stuff, I was like, oh, maybe I should have brought, you'd read some of the nautical stuff, because it's a nautical fiction work. Mm. But anyway, I didn't. I wish I had some, like Herman Melville, I could just recite, call me Ishmael. There, okay. anyway, I also want to promote another literary event that's happening in Davis on Thursday, the 23rd, and it will be at the Pence Gallery in downtown Davis. I have some flyers here and also on the table. It's called Unloaded. I'm not reading at this, but I helped organize it, and I'll be emceeing the event also. It is co-sponsored by the Yolo County and Sacramento Valley chapters of the Brady campaign. I actually helped found the Yolo County chapter after the Sandy Hook shooting. And it's interesting that you read that poem that had a lot to do with gun violence, because it's something, gun violence prevention is something I've been somewhat involved with for years. And anyway, there's an anthology series called Unloaded, which features crime fiction writers who've written stories that don't involve firearms. They do involve other forms of violence and death. So it's not like it's peaceable fiction or anything. But anyway, four of them are coming to read from their stories on Thursday at the Pence Gallery. It's free. And so there's this kind of interesting like juxtaposition of gun violence prevention activism and creativity. So anyway, I commend that to all of you. And if you're interested, pick up a flyer. It will be fun and very different. I'm going to read, I'm going to read a variety of things, including some poetry translations and a very short story that I just finished writing a few weeks ago, and a small new piece of nonfiction that was recently published. So I was joking with my husband before we left Sacramento that the only thing I'm not bringing is a play. Anyway, and I'm also going to change up a little bit the order in which I'm reading these things. I think I'm going to read the nonfiction piece first, which is at the end here. Sorry. When you go not first at a thing, you end up like changing what you're doing. It's partly in response to the writer who came before you. And Amanda, that was also beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. This is a short piece of nonfiction that I recently wrote. I wrote it last year, and it was published early this year in a relatively new literary journal called The Bear Life Review. And they accept poetry and fiction and nonfiction from immigrant and refugee writers. So check it out. They're also a paying venue. So if you were born outside the country, check it out. This is called Fukuoka Airport. It's also one sentence. It's two pages, but it's one sentence. My first experience of heartbreak occurred one unsuspecting morning in the spring of 1969 when I was 5 years old in Fukuoka, the city in southern Japan where I was born. At the airport, still under U.S. military control, but recently opened to civilian flights with Japan Airlines, and that's why we were there. My mother, my younger sister, my grandmother, my uncle, me, to see off my father, flying from Fukuoka to Osaka to Tokyo and thence to L.A. to return to the U.S., to start a new life for us, a life my mother and sister and I would join 6 months later. But when you are only 5 years old, 6 months might as well be 6 years. And I adored my father. I did. So when I realized what was happening, that he was leaving us, that he was leaving me, that he was heading for that gate and we were not going with him, I was not going with him, that in fact the rest of us were going to leave the airport and return to my grandmother's tiny one-room apartment, the tiny apartment above my grandmother's tiny restaurant in the bustling Imaizumi district of the city. Without my father, I declared in Japanese, the only language I knew then, I want to go to America too. And I thought they would let me, especially after I started crying, which embarrassed my Japanese mother and grandmother, because at 5, I was supposed to be too old for that sort of display. But I didn't care, because I knew that if only they could all see that I was in earnest, that I meant it, they would relent and I would prevail and proceed through that gate hand in hand with my father, never mind that I had no luggage and no plane ticket. So when my father seemed to falter his gaijin face pink with emotion, eyes shining. I thought I'd succeeded. I thought he would say, in Japanese, a language he'd learned to speak perfectly, the only language we shared then, "Okay, Naomi-chan, let's go." But instead, he took his hand from mine and disappeared through the gate while my uncle held me back. And I couldn't believe it. I opened my mouth and wailed, not caring one bit that I was making a spectacle of myself, that I was making things harder for everyone. I stood alone and unshakable in my grief. I wept all the way back on the train, on the bus, on foot, up the stairs to my grandmother's tiny apartment. And I remained tearful the rest of the day, hiccuping over the dinner my mother brought up from the restaurant. And when I woke up the next morning, still sad, I understood for the first time about sadness that could go on and on. But I did not understand and could not have foreseen the more enduring sorrows that awaited me and my sister and my mother in our new life in America with a man who, it turned out, was hopelessly damaged and could not help damaging people he claimed to love. No, I could not have foreseen any of that, or how 43 years later, when he died at age 70 from complications of a treatable cancer whose symptoms he had ignored until it was too late, I would not have seen him for over two decades. How I would feel only relief that he was finally, irrevocably gone from my life and from the world. How the keenest grief I would ever experience for him I had already spent the previous morning at the gate in Fukuoka Airport. I'll move on now to a piece of fiction. This is a complete short story, very short. I just wrote it last month. I was at a residency in Washington State. No one has heard this before, and this has not been published or anything, so this is brand new. All I will say about it is that it's based loosely on something that someone told me, and that in the style and its length and tone, perhaps, it's most influenced perhaps by Lucia Berlin. I don't know if any of you have read her or are fans of hers. She was a fantastic short story writer. Her collection, which was published posthumously and is called A Manual for Cleaning Women, is one of the finest collections of short stories I've ever read. Each piece is like this perfect tiny gem. And many of them just start very conversationally as if the narrator's telling you something casually, and then it often takes this weird turn that you didn't expect, and you end up someplace you just did not see coming at the beginning of the story. So this was kind of what I was going for. It's called In Ireland. When people who aren't writers meet a writer, they often say, "Oh, I've got a great story for you," as if writers are technicians waiting for other people's stuff to work on, like a car mechanic or a vet. It's the weirdest thing. Sometimes they'll bend your ear with some unsolicited personal anecdote, then say, "What do you think of that? Good story, right? You're welcome." An old boyfriend of mine did this to me once. We'd only gone out during freshman year of college, but remained friendly enough afterward. The summer after we graduated, he went to Ireland for a few weeks. At the end of that summer, I was marrying the guy I started seeing sophomore year. Max, the ex, came back to the States in time to attend our wedding and gave us a set of beautiful Irish table linens, white and subtly patterned with flowers. I still have them. We rarely use them, so they're in excellent shape. A few months after the wedding, the phone rang, and it was Max. It was early, too early to call, but he was about to board a flight for San Francisco, and he'd be in town till tomorrow, and could he stay with us? "Sure," I said, groggily. "We'll be at work, so take a cab to our place, let yourself in." I explained where we hid a spare key. "We'll be home around 6. When my husband and I came home, Max had already opened and consumed half a bottle of the Zinfandel we'd been planning to serve with dinner that night. "I should have bought another bottle of wine," my husband said, apologetically. Max said nothing. I cannot abide conversational silence, so I said, "It's fine," although it wasn't. Max could have run out for more wine if he was going to drink so much, or at least have said, "No, I'm the one who should be sorry." On the other hand, my husband's comment seemed passive-aggressive, the way it called attention to Max's drinking. The wild mushroom risotto we made was delicious, but dinner felt strained. My husband said goodnight early. He's always been a sensible, early-to-bed, early-to-rise type. He also had a class first thing in the morning. He just started law school. Max found a couple of beers in the back of the fridge, and we stayed up late talking in the living room. He seemed impervious to jet lag. I tried to tell him about a novel I wanted to write, an autobiographical thing about a girl with literary ambitions growing up among evangelical Christians. He looked bored, and I felt the same fear of losing his interest that I used to feel when we were dating. Anyway, that's the idea for the book, I said sheepishly. It'll probably come to nothing. He leaned forward. Here's a better story for you, he said, then told me in minute detail about a day from his trip to Ireland the previous summer. He'd been walking around aimlessly for miles along the coast. I don't know where he was. He must have told me, but this was a long time ago, and I've never been to Ireland, so have little sense of its geography. At any rate, he ended up at some point in a lush field whose only occupant was a territorial bull that chased him till he leapt over what was probably a life-saving fence. I laughed in that way you do when someone tells you about a close call. Oh, it gets better, he said, draining his bottle of beer. Shaken, Max had made his way to what looked like a well-trodden public path. Parts of it snaked along cliff sides that plunged hundreds of feet below to rocks and ocean. You would have hated it, he said, remembering my fear of heights. It's not just fear of falling, I said. It's like I'm afraid I'll succumb to some primal urge to jump. Exactly, he said, then told me that he reached a point on the path where he could look straight down to a rocky cove and a beach below. And while one part of his brain was trying to figure out if there were some way down to the beach, another part was telling him to just step off the edge. He stood there for a moment, overcome by the beauty of the place and his own insignificance and the ease with which it could all end. But reason won out, plus he saw a path carved out of the hillside down to the water. So instead of smashing to pieces on the rocks below, he hiked down the trail to the base of the cliff. And guess what I found there, right below the point where I'd been standing only a few minutes earlier contemplating my own demise. You're kidding, I said. Why would I kid, he said with easy belligerence. It's just an expression of surprised interest, Max. When we'd been dating, this knee-jerk combativeness of his had hurt my feelings again and again. Now I reached for my beer, but the bottle was empty. So you found a body? It was a man, he told me, thin, probably young, although it was hard to tell as he was face down. Max returned to the cliff-hugging trail, where he met a couple making their own way down. They went to alert the authorities while Max stayed on the beach. Eventually, the police showed up and a coroner type, and they figured the accident or suicide or whatever had occurred less than an hour before I found the guy. Jesus, I said, what if you'd happened by just a few minutes earlier? I think about that a lot, he said. Maybe I could have saved a life. Maybe you'd have the additional trauma of witnessing someone falling or jumping off a cliff. He fixed his blue eyes on me. They looked glassy, unfocused, but I remembered the way they had once mesmerized me. I don't feel traumatized, he said. Okay, sure. I just thought you might find it an interesting story. It is an interesting story. You should write it, he said. You should write it. I don't claim to be a writer, he said. I stood up to collect our empty bottles and take them to the kitchen, where I pressed my fingers against my eyes to keep the sting from turning into tears. When I returned, he had discovered our liquor cabinet and selected an expensive bottle of port someone had given us as a wedding present. I'm saving that one for our anniversary, I said. Then why is it out where a guest might mistake it as available? I've never had a guest before who drank so much of our alcohol without even asking. He set the bottle back down with a thunk that made me wince, then crossed the room to the armchair where I was sitting. He put his hands around my head, snaking his fingers into my hair hard, and pulled my face back to look up at him. I didn't know I had to stand on ceremony with you, he said. And I thought he was going to lean over or pull me up out of the chair and kiss me, and I knew I wouldn't stop him if he did, but he let go and sat back down on the couch without a word. This time, I knew I couldn't keep the tears back. "Good night, Max," I managed before leaving the room. I hated crying in front of people. I still do. But crying in front of Max had never just been embarrassing. Every time felt like a defeat in some game I didn't like and didn't want to play but couldn't avoid. The next morning, I found an empty bottle of rum in the trash. The bottle had only been one-third full, but still. I moved it to the recycling bin before rapping on his door. "I called you a cab for 8:30, I said. The door opened after a series of grunts. "My plane doesn't leave till 11, he said, peering at me with just one eye open. "I need to leave for work," he sighed. "Okay, I get it." That was 30 years ago. I never saw him again and have no idea what became of him. These days, I think of him only on special occasions when I pull out that Irish tablecloth. Then I also remember that story he told me about the day in Ireland when he was nearly gored by a bull and considered jumping from a cliff only a few minutes after someone else had. And I wonder about the younger me, why I'd once found a guy like him so compelling, what it was about him, what it was about me. I never did write that autobiographical novel, but now I've written his story, so I suppose he can chalk up another win. Okay. I'm going to conclude with a few poems. Some of you know that I've been working for years now on a second novel. It's called Akiko in Paris, and it's about a true-life Japanese poet. Yosano Akiko was her name. She lived from 1878 to 1940. She was a very famous poet during her lifetime and remains a famous poet in Japan. Everyone in Japan has heard of her. And she was a practitioner of the poetic form called tanka. And some of you who know something about Japanese poetry may know what that is. Everyone knows what a haiku is because we were all forced to write them in English, I think an abominable practice. Anyway, in elementary school, and you know, it's like three lines, five, seven, five syllables, right? Okay, so a tanka is actually a much more common and more traditional and older form of Japanese poetry. There's much more tanka in Japanese literature than there is haiku. A haiku is just an abbreviated tanka. So a haiku goes 5, 7, 5, 7, 7. There are two additional lines at the end. So Akiko was a writer of tanka. She wrote thousands of tanka during her relatively long life. And in 1912, she farmed her seven children out to the care of relatives. The children were all under age 10. The youngest one was not even one yet. And she left for 6 months. And she traveled to Europe by herself. This was absolutely unheard of for a woman to do that in Japan at the time, much less like a married woman with children. Her husband was already in Europe. She had sent him ahead. And so he was, you know, being an artist in Europe, and then she decided to follow him. So she did that. And the novel is about her year away from home. And so for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been translating all the tanka that she wrote about this experience, and there were like 250. So this was very challenging because my Japanese is quite rusty, and I'm not a poet. but she didn't really keep a diary. Her poems are where you find out what happened to her or what she was thinking about or what she saw during this trip. So anyway, I just brought in three. In some of my translations, I've actually attempted to mirror that 5-7-5-7-7 construct to sort of give you a feel for just like, I don't know, the rhythm of hearing that many syllables in that arrangement. It's actually quite hard to do this, and if a translation feels contrived doing that, I ditch it. But this first one, I did attempt that pattern, 5-7-5-7-7. She wrote this about arriving in France, and it was in May, almost exactly 107 years ago. And if any of you have been in France in late spring, you know there are these red poppies everywhere, and they're amazing. In French, that flower is called coquelicot, and she actually uses a sort of Japanized form of that word in the poem. You'll probably hear it. What I'll do is I'll read the poem in Japanese twice, and then I'll read my translation. Well, you know what? I'll read the Japanese, and then I'll read the translation, and then I'll read the Japanese again. Sandra McPherson once told me that if you're reading Japanese poetry, you have to read it twice. So the second time I read the Japanese, you might actually be able to hear some of those words, which are borrowed words from English or French. Okay, so the first one goes like this. Ah, Satsuki. Furansu no no wa hi no iro su. Kimi mo kokuriko, ware mo kokuriko. It's May already. The fields of France are ablaze with the sun's own hues. My love, you are kokuriko, and I too am kokuriko. So I'll read it in Japanese again. Ah, Satsuki. Furansu no no wa hi no iro su. Kimi mo kokuriko, ware mo kokuriko. The next one is a poem that she wrote about Notre Dame. So I thought it would be a nice thing to read that, given what happened recently at Notre Dame. Kimi to yuku Notre Dame no to bakari, usumomo iro ni nokoru yugure. With you at Notre Dame, the pale rose colors of twilight lingered only on the towers. Kimi to yuku Notre Dame no to bakari, usumomo iro ni nokoru yugure. So the last poem I'm going to read, and this is the last thing I'm going to read, is about saying goodbye to Europe. And, you know, we talk today, we often talk sort of casually about once-in-a-lifetime experiences, which just means this was outstanding, right? But if you were a person in Asia in 1912 and you went to Europe, especially if you were a woman, it probably was literally your once in a, that was your one time, right? When we talk about, say, going to Rome or something, and it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, or going to the Grand Canyon or something, most of us have some sense that we might be able to do that again, right? I mean, we might have to spend some time saving up money or get in better shape or whatever, but, you know. But when Akiko went to France, when she thought about leaving Europe and going back to Japan, she knew she would never come back to Europe again. And that's true. She never went to Europe again. She only left the country one other time, and it was to go to Manchuria in the 1930s under the auspices of the fascist Japanese government to write about how great the Japanese occupation was. Yeah, another a very troublesome part of her history that I might write a novel about one day, but not now. This is about her sadness about leaving Europe. Ikite yo ni mata min koto no katakaraba kanashikaramashi kureyuku pari. It's terrible knowing I'll never see this again in life. If only the darkening city of Paris could feel sad for me. Ikite yo ni mata min koto no katakaraba kanashikaramashi kureru yuku pari. Thank you.